Hey there, and welcome back to Holistic Health Masterclass Podcast with me, your host, Brett Hawes. I hope you have been doing extremely well. It has been a crazy busy time for me the last couple of weeks with some online events, some in-person events, and so on, which is exactly why you are getting this podcast a little late, for those of you who are subscribers to the show. But anyway, I hope you've enjoyed some of the live stuff I've been doing and online presentations and whatnot. For those of you who have not checked in, totally cool and all good. Right, so I am just going to hop right into today's show. And today's show is a real secret passion of mine, if you will. And it's an area of medicine or health or spirituality, because it kind of traverses all of those. It's an area that I've spent, I would say, most of my life in, and it's an area that I was definitely interested in long before I got into the world of things like nutrition and functional medicine and so on. So today we are talking with Guy Crittenden, who is the author of A Year of Drinking Magic. And really, the focal point for today's discussion is all about ayahuasca and shamanic medicine. Guy has a very interesting background. He actually dedicated 25 years of his life to a corporate career. He is, in fact, an award-winning journalist and editor who spent his corporate career in the environmental sector, so working on magazines and so on. He has been published in numerous outlets, including the Globe and Mail newspaper, Saturday Night magazine, and has been a finalist in the National Magazine Awards twice. But here's the cool thing is, after a life-changing trip to Peru in 2013, his sort of spiritual journey, his spiritual inklings, his spiritual side, whichever way you want to look at that, really got rekindled and reactivated. And that prompted him to really dive quite deep into the world of ayahuasca, consciousness, spirituality, and to really dive into his own sort of his personal self to overcome some of the challenges that he might have been dealing with, but also to really make a concerted effort, if you will, to reach his highest spiritual potential. So that's really what we're talking about today. And I know that a lot of you listening, you know, I know that this is something that is very, very interesting. It's something that people ask me about all the time. And I think that what you're going to find in this particular episode, we talk quite frankly about what the experience actually is. I also talk a lot about my time living with the indigenous people here in Canada and travels elsewhere. But what does it actually look like? What does it feel like? What does one expect? What is the experience like? And I think that if you are intrigued and you've been thinking about doing something like this, this is definitely an episode you want to tune into, because Guy is a person that has done it, and he's done it a lot. He has also approached this with the utmost respect, I will say, for the plant medicine, because we're really talking about powerful medicine that, if you're not prepared, it is going to rock your socks. This is really the quickest way that I know of to tap into the subconscious, that amygdala brain, the reptilian brain, and to really, really have profound insights and shifts into your spiritual self and your higher consciousness. So, you know, I'm pretty psyched. It's a great conversation. As I said, it's an area that I absolutely love. And, you know, if you haven't listened to the previous episode with Darren Austin Hall, you should go and check that one out as well. We are all mutual friends. And, you know, we definitely dive into a little bit of that stuff in the previous episode. So anyway, I am going to just hop right into this episode. And without further delay, I bring you Guy Crittenden. Okay, so welcome to the show, Guy. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
So, Guy, we've had some good conversations between the two of us. I've been keeping up to speed with a lot of what you've been posting and speak about online. And we will obviously be talking about your recent book that you've published. But before we get into that, you know, really the focal point of today's discussion and our hangout today is really, we're going to talk a lot about your own spiritual journey, what that led to, of course, then the book that's come out, and we'll dive into all of that. But perhaps, you know, looking at your background, you know, starting out or at least dedicating a large portion of your life as a writer and editor for essentially environmental publications and an award-winning one at that, how did you find yourself getting into things like ayahuasca, spirituality, and so on? How did that really happen for you?
Well, I sometimes call it walking backwards into enlightenment. not that I'm enlightened yet. But this is not something I sought out at all. A lot of it was accident. And I'm one of those people that the universe had to, on whose door the universe had to knock very loudly to get my attention. So I had to endure some quite profound assaults to my adherence to the scientist and rational materialist paradigm to wake up to the fact that there's more to this universe than I had been led to believe.
Yeah, right. Because, I mean, in our casual conversations, you sort of described yourself as a guy who dedicated 25 years to professional, you know, corporate career, family life, et cetera, and, you know, didn't really consider yourself a spiritual person, quote unquote, and until you started experiencing some of the things that we're going to be talking about today. So, you know, I think a lot of the people that are listening to this, when we talk about spirituality, when we talk about this, you know, rising of consciousness, this awakening, I think a lot of people can really resonate with your story coming from the so-called 3D world and then stepping out fully into their spiritual selves.
Yes. There have been times when I've thought of that as a disadvantage, but as a professional communicator, I do value it because I've been down in the trenches with everybody else and I've lived some of my life unconsciously. So as I go through my journey, I'm not only enjoying and benefiting from the realizations that I'm having, but I can articulate those to people with compassion and in a way that they can hear the message because I used to think just as they do. So I can, sometimes when I'm writing or talking, I try to talk to the person I was maybe 15 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think, you know, there's obviously, I've also been a professional educator as well for a long time. And, you know, in the sort of holistic space and spiritual space for that matter, for perhaps even longer. And I've noticed that as well. You know, a lot of people, because they haven't had the sort of lightning bolt or Disney experience that we're looking for, a lot of times we sort of think about spirituality and we really intellectualize it without having really experienced it. And so that's what I find interesting about your story, because it is quite common. It's actually a lot more common than other people who perhaps experience this massive spiritual side of things first and then actually have a hard time grounding themselves, because there's a huge crowd like that as well. So, but all of this, I mean, you know, you've said to me off air, there were some signs that started kicking in even from a very young age, right? So, I mean, you share an experience in your book about when you were a little kid, something around sunrise. Perhaps you can sort of elaborate on that for us a little bit.
Yeah, that's a good starting point. I grew up in the neighborhood of Moore Park in Toronto, which is a very middle-class or upper-middle-class neighborhood. It's a place with lots of large homes and leafy trees and tennis courts, and life is good. You know, you could grow up in that neighborhood and just live a very unconscious life, because life could become very comfortable. But one day, I was 13 years old, and I had a very strange experience, which I didn't understand at the time, but I would now, with my current understanding, look back on it and say it was a kind of Satori experience, or a first glimmering of an awakening. And in fact, it's something that I've thought about from time to time for my whole adult life. So I was about 13, and I was, it was a rainy night, and I tossed and turned and had a lot of dreams that night. And for reasons that will always be mysterious, I got up before sunrise, got dressed, went downstairs. I remember writing a strange incantation on a piece of paper and taking it outside, putting it in the stump of a tree and burning the piece of paper, which was very ritualistic and I've never done before or since for that matter. And then I walked, I felt pulled almost like by a magnet to walk a long distance across. I crossed a bridge, crossed the ravine near my parents' house into a neighboring neighborhood that I wasn't very familiar with. And I sat on a height of land and that was overlooking the city of Toronto, which was just about to begin to start coming to wake. And I watched the sunrise. And the point of the story was that I had an instantaneous experience. It's indescribable, but the best I could do is to say that I instantly had a sense as the sun rose as a big sort of orange ball that, you know, it wasn't a flat sphere like we often see it in the sky, but it was very much a round sphere. And I had a profound sense of its exact size relative to the size of the earth and the exact distance from the earth to the sun. Now, this was just like in a flash. And then the weirdest part, as if that wasn't strange enough, was I had a sense that I was looking at the sun and it was looking back at me. That it was a conscious entity. And just for that brief moment that lasted a split second, I had a sudden awareness that the universe is ensouled and that everything is conscious. And then I went home and I did think about that over the years, but it wasn't until much later when I was starting to study Buddhism and read books about Zen Buddhism and so on that I was able to begin unpacking that experience.
And I think that, you know, there is a pretty profound experience, especially for a young kid. And I wondered to myself, you know, I'm sure that we all have these types of experiences. Again, maybe not the Disney, you know, wow kind of experience, but we have all of these experiences as we go through life. And it really takes paying attention to start tapping into these type of experiences, right? Yes. And it sounds like you had that experience. It sort of floated around in the conscious mind for a while, and then you sort of pushed it to the back and just carried on with life, right? I mean,
Yes. And one of the issues, of course, is that our society itself is governed by a materialist dogma or a bias in its philosophical understanding of the fundamental nature of reality, which ironically was actually disproven in the early 20th century by the leading physicists, and the rest of the world hasn't caught up with it. So this is not cultivated in our culture. We don't live in a spiritual culture. We don't live we certainly don't live in a shamanic culture. No. So instead of going to our elders, say, and reporting an experience like that, and then they would say, okay, they'll contextualize it for us. We often don't even talk about it because we don't feel that it would be received well. And these sorts of things tend to not even be discussed around the dinner table. So.
No, I think you're absolutely correct. You know, again, living in more of a left brain, logical, materialistic kind of existence, a lot of these types of experiences are simply buried, or they're in fact taboo. You know, it wasn't that long ago that if you started talking about these types of experiences, you were branded a witch or you were branded as completely crazy. So obviously, you know, we will work our way into shamanism and where things are headed on a more global scale. I definitely want to talk about that a little bit later on, because I do feel that we are in some type of spiritual renaissance of some kind. And again, maybe we can dive into that in a little bit. So you have this experience as a kid. Now, did you have any other experiences? I mean, did these types of things keep happening to you, or did you just sort of lay quote unquote dormant for a while until later in life?
It's a bit of both. I got a degree in English and I specialized in poetry. And then after that, I had a, well, to use the word career might be a bit overblown, but I pursued a career as a visual artist. And I was very drawn toward surrealism. And I read some Jung and Freud, and I was very interested in doing paintings and drawings, for example, that tapped into my subconscious. So in my early to mid-20s, I was aware, I always sensed there's something more, there's something beyond a sort of invisible, semi-permeable membrane that I kept trying to hack into. And I didn't have a shamanic or spiritual frame reference system to interpret what I was thinking. So I always put it in the terms of Freudian psychology or art. So maybe if I'd lived in a tribal society, they would have said, oh, this young man has sightedness. Let's go have him apprentice with the village shaman.
Exactly, yeah.
But in our culture, you tend to be told, oh, you're very artistic. So I tended to steer those leanings toward visual art and stuff. And, you know, it's very hard to make a living at that. And I really mm-hmm. love art, but I don't really like the art world and the gallery system and that. So I eventually moved on and did other things. But one of the things that did jolt me again, it was another nudge. And in fact, this time it was more of a kick in the pants from the universe. It was 1984, and I went on a 6-week trip to Brazil, and I talk about this in the book. I was in Rio de Janeiro at a time when the economy was collapsing, and I was having a good time, but a lot of people in the middle class and the store owners were going bankrupt. It was so bad, in fact, that the currency was changed while I was down there. It's kind of like Germany in the early 1930s. And they changed the Cruzeiro to the Cruzado or something like that. And I got violently robbed there. My friend Matthew had come down to visit for a couple of weeks, and we were in my apartment. And I won't tell the story in lurid detail because it would take too long, but the elevator pitch for it was that he and I were tied up and pistol whipped, and all our money and passports and everything was taken. And it would have been natural for the thieves to simply leave. It was a young man and woman. And the woman went over to my bed and took one of the pillowcases and wrapped the muzzle of the gun with it and planted each of her feet on either side of my head and lowered the gun to blow my head off. And just as she was about to pull the trigger, the doorbell rang. And it rang and rang and rang and rang. And that sort of spooked the thieves. And after a while, when whoever it was, if there was someone on the other side of the door, I'm still not sure about that, they took off. And, you know, up until that point, I'd absorbed the rationalist dominator culture perspective of reality. So I was atheist and I was an existentialist and proud of it. And in school, I'd studied people like Albert Camus and Jean-Paul Sartre. So I was very, very rational atheist. And that near miss, that cheating death, haunted me for a long time, because honestly, I can't think of another time in the whole 6 weeks I was in Brazil that doorbell was rang by anybody. What are the odds that it would ring just as somebody's squeezing the trigger to blow my head off? Yeah. So I didn't go immediately onto a spiritual path, but it got me wondering. And a few years later, I found myself living in Santa Monica, and a friend took me to a New Age bookstore, and I kind of loaded up on books on Buddhism and started listening to Alan Watts tapes. you know, back in those days, it was cassettes that you'd listen to in the car on a ghetto blaster. but I really got into Alan Watts, and I discovered Ram Dass and a few other people, and it started planting seeds in my mind, and I came across a statement by Watts that was something to the effect that each of us is a local manifestation of a non-local universal intelligence. So that seed was planted. But then, you know, when I was 30 years old, I got married. I became a partner in a small publishing business. A few years later, my wife and I had kids. We had two sons who are mostly grown up now. And I was doing good work. It was the magazines were in the environmental services business. They were about pollution control and recycling and that. So it was all really good, worthwhile work. And I did well from it financially. But really, all the spiritual stuff and deep ontological questions were on the back burner for about 25 years.
Which is, I mean, that's some pretty hardcore persistence and dedication to continue with that type of life, knowing that you've had that type of experience and then asking those kinds of questions, right? You know, I mean, speaking from my own experience, I definitely haven't had as intense of an experience as you. I've definitely almost lost my life a couple of times, but I won't go there today. But it's more when those types of questions started piquing my interest, I just went for it, right? I just took it. And so I find it interesting that the ebb and flow of your own spiritual journey, right? Because fast forward to 2013, 2014, which is now what, 20 years after this experience for you, after the Brazil experience, 25 years?
Yeah, more than 25.
Oh. And this is where we sort of pick things up with you sort of essentially walking into the jungle, and it was in Peru, if I'm not mistaken.
I was reading a book recently, and I realized that my life story could very much be framed in terms of the Indian, as in India, template of the life of the householder. You know, I was a householder and a family man for many years, and in some ways I still am. But in the Indian tradition, there's an idea that once your children are grown up and you've been a householder, then you can turn your attention in the sort of the final act of your life toward the more the contemplative and spiritual things. So I was in the year before I went to Peru, so that must have been 2012, my stepfather died, and that made a great impression on me. I'd been divorced for a few years and was living in a small community outside Toronto where I didn't have the greatest social life because, you know, when you get divorced, a lot of your friends will tend to pull away. Mm-hmm. So I wasn't really in the greatest place, I would say. I was getting very sick of my job. It was getting to be time to move on. Worthwhile though the work was, I didn't feel that I wanted it to say on my gravestone, you know, that he was a trade magazine editor. So it's time to shake things up. And I can't even say that I really thought it through a lot, but I had a girlfriend who had drank ayahuasca and had told me about it. And that planted the idea in my mind of, it fascinated me a lot. So I started, and I had had an experience with LSD in my 20s that we don't need to go into, but that had been somewhat paradigm shifting. So when I heard about ayahuasca, I researched it. At that time, there weren't a lot of great books about it, and there weren't a lot of blogs about it, unlike today. I mean, a lot has changed in the past 3 or 4 years. There was the Jeremy Narby book. What's the name of that one again?
I know which one you're talking about. This, it's got the snake on the front of it. I know exactly which book you're talking about.
The Cosmic Serpent.
That's right. Yeah, The Cosmic Serpent.
That was a great book. And
really good book.
That was one of several things that got me thinking. And so in December 2013, I traveled with a startup, a travel company, called Pulse Tours, which is owned by my friend. Yeah, he's still my friend, Dan Cleland. What they offered was something that really appealed to me because, you know, I'd been writing about the environment for 25 years, but hadn't honestly spent a lot of time in it. And the Amazon, of course, is the mecca for environmentalists. So I thought, I really want to go down to see the Amazon and do some trekking. And then I thought, I'd really also like to try ayahuasca while I'm there. But it seemed that most of the companies like G Tours that offered the trekking didn't offer the ayahuasca and vice versa.
Right.
Anyway, Dan's a bright guy. He had been a guide for G Tours, and he saw the opportunity that there were a lot of his clients that he was leading on treks that also wanted to do work with the plant medicines. So he started a company to do that and has done very well. So I went on one of that company's first tours, and we changed planes in Lima, went to Iquitos for a couple of days, and then went by moto taxi and boat to a small village called Libertad on the Amazon, and did 4 or 5 days of wilderness treks, which was really great. And I got to see, you know, the monkeys and the pink dolphins and all the kind of stuff you want to see on those things.
So real jungle adventure then.
Yeah, it was pretty rigorous too. The group that I fell in with was mostly a group of young guys from Southern Ontario that they were friends with each other and friends with Dan. And some of them were childhood friends, but I didn't know them. Some of them remain friends of mine to this day. We kind of bonded like an army platoon down there because it was pretty rigorous. These guys were athletic and young, and we did three treks a day. So there'd be a morning trek, afternoon, and evening. And I remember there was this one day I was getting pretty tired, and I had the opportunity to skip one of the treks and just stay back at the jungle lodge and read and sit in a hammock or something. I thought, no, I can't let the guys down. I got to be part of it. So it was intense and it was fun. And it was a wonderful thing to saturate myself in that environment of the Amazon before going to a retreat center and drinking ayahuasca. I had a very clean diet, lots of exercise, but also just being in that environment was a great headspace for a paradigm shifting experience.
So tell me something, if I can just interject. So you know, you're having a slightly rough time in life. Things are changing for you. You go down there. Now your mindset going into this, because I really want to talk about this for a minute, because a lot of people, you know, I've spoken to a lot of people about ayahuasca, about DMT, about San Pedro, psilocybin, like basically psychedelics. And I know that a lot of people are very interested, but a lot of people don't really know what to expect, first of all. And I don't know, perhaps get your thoughts on this, but I think also a lot of people are going into it with the expectation that their problems are just going to magically disappear, or you know what I'm saying? Like, because it's a pretty intense experience. I mean, let's face it. It's an intense experience. I've always said to people, you have to be in the right headspace, or at least be prepared for what's coming. Mm-hmm. And so perhaps you can speak to those points a little more about where you were at in terms of your mindset going into it. And then, of course, really we want to get to your experience, and we'll talk a little bit more about the actual title of your book in a second as well.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, well, I would say... I wouldn't say I was deeply depressed, but I was mildly depressed, and I was not an alcoholic, but I was somewhat, I had developed an unhealthy relationship with alcohol, particularly whiskey. I never had a problem really with beer or wine, much as I like them. But whiskey was the one that kind of snuck up on me, frankly. And so I was self-medicating a little bit with that in the years since my separation. And it's funny because it's not like I went to Peru in order to solve that problem. I didn't even feel that I had a problem, which is pretty typical, right?
But, yeah, exactly.
but that was there. And so on a conscious level, I had an agenda, but I think subconsciously and spiritually, my soul was looking to solve some problems that were not in the, had not tapped into my frontal cortex at that time. Mm-hmm. So it's funny because I got a lot of healing out of the ayahuasca experience, but I was not one of those people that had a specific condition who went down there for that healing. When I was down there, of course, I met people with depression, anxiety, PTSD, chronic fatigue syndrome, mm-hmm. Crohn's disease, all those kind of autoimmune and psychological chronic conditions that our technocratic medical system in North America is not good at working with. Mm-hmm. And I need to qualify that by saying, you know, if I'm in a car accident or if I have a gunshot wound, there's no place I'd rather be than the ICU of a modern hospital.
Absolutely, yeah.
So we're really, being a materialist culture, we're really good at patching people up when it's a mechanical, you know, biomechanical problem. But where we really fail people is, I don't need to tell you, in the areas of nutrition and such, but also with these sort of conditions where you have to treat the whole patient and you have to treat them not just physically, but also psychologically and spiritually. And yeah. this is what the shamans or the curanderos of Peru and Brazil are brilliant at. This is what they do.
Yeah, I mean, you know, spot on. Like, I've been saying this for years in a lot of my classes, my writings, the interviews that I've done with people, where, yeah, I've always looked at holistic health and holistic medicine as exactly that. You know, when we talk about body, mind, and soul, you know, the doctor is, and I'll say this very loosely with a bit of a sort of slack jaw, the doctor is very good at treating the physical. We then have the psychiatrists, the psychotherapists, and whatnot to treat the mental. And then you have the pastor, priest, guru, whatever you want to look at for the spiritual side of things. And, you know, the way that I was taught through a number of different modalities and my own experience is that consciousness flows into thought, which flows into emotion, and then flows into the physical. And there's no way that you can separate any of those. They're all intertwined. And I think you're spot on in that we really here in the West, because it's a materialistic type culture, we tend to focus on the materialistic things, aka our physical health. And I personally have had a number of clients that have seen me in practice where you start scratching a little deeper at the surface and you're like, whoa, man, I think that a lot of your deeper seated issues are actually mental, emotional, or in fact, spiritual issues. And as you said, I mean, we don't really have a solution with the system that we're currently operating on here in the West. And that's what's always fascinated me about shamanic medicine, about plant medicine, and about psychedelics, because it's really the fastest way to tap into that type of medicine.
Yes, it is. And of course, in the indigenous societies, the tribal societies, they never really had that specialization and division of the priest, doctor, psychologist into three different things. The medicine holder for the tribe would be the intermediary with other forces for the healing. And when they're good at what they do, they, in a sense, get out of the way and let other, let's just say, non-conventional sources of healing come in. And this is something that, of course, in Europe and North America and other technocratic societies, we've been conditioned to dismiss as woo-woo
And, well, because we can't prove them, right? There's no, you know, we haven't taken a photograph of them. We can't really look at a study. We can't quantify it or measure it. Yeah. So if we can't do any of those things, then it's just regarded as, oh, well, you know, it's delusional or it's fantasy, right?
Yes. And fortunately, word is starting to get out. I mean, I know here in Canada, there's a lot of people who I know some of them personally have had addiction issues and have not been, you know, conventional treatment has not been successful, but they're going out to BC and they're working with Iboga, the, yeah. The root drug or bark drug of the, the Ubuntu tribe or whatever.
Yeah, from West Africa. Yeah.
Yeah. And they're having, I'm told, success rates of 80% or higher. I'm not sure what the number is, but it's certainly dramatically higher than the other therapies that they're
doing. Well, and I've done a lot of research into Ibogaine or Iboga, and, you know, there are clinics. I don't know if they still exist because I think the government might have actually shut them down. You know, we won't get into that, but that, you know, people taking one dose of Ibogaine and just never touching whatever their addiction is ever again, which is unheard of. I mean, I don't know of anything else that can do that.
Yeah, crazy, right? My understanding is they keep getting dosed on an hourly basis over a period of a couple of days sometimes. But if it's not available in BC, I know people could, I mean, if myself or a relative was in that situation, I'd have them on a plane very quickly down to Costa Rica or wherever else the stuff is legal to do, because, you know, it puts you in direct contact with spirit. And the mirror gets held up to your childhood traumas, which are the source of addiction anyway, at least according to Gabor Mate, who I respect. Mm-hmm. And certainly my own experiences with ayahuasca and San Pedro cactus and other entheogens has shown me very directly why that might be.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So let's jump right into it here, because the title of your book, as we said in the intro, The Year of Drinking Magic, 12 Ceremonies with the Vine of Souls.
Yes.
And perhaps just walk us through what that title really means and how this unfolded.
Well, the title was fun to come up with. People may pick up that there's an alliteration or a genuflection to two other books, The Year of Magical Thinking and also The Year of Living Dangerously. So I wanted my book to fall into that family of, you know, paradigm shifting years, which have a sort of a sense of mystery and danger about them. The 12 ceremonies with the Vine of Souls, of course, refers to ayahuasca, which is also sometimes called the Vine of the Dead. And again, because my stepfather had passed the year before, one of the big questions I was pondering was, you know, what happens when we die? And I was very unsatisfied with the answers our society offers. So I thought maybe I would get some answers to some deep ontological questions, which I did. And what happened was I drank ayahuasca three times when I was in Peru. And then when I came back to Canada, I drank a further nine times. Even though it's not strictly legal here, it does take place quietly thus far. Law enforcement doesn't seem terribly interested in it. Anyway, I decided to do that because I wanted to continue to work with the plant. So every time I would have an ayahuasca ceremony, the next day I'd write down as much as I could remember of what I'd seen and what I'd experienced and the teachings and so on. And so after the end of a year or so, I had a pretty robust journal full of these accounts. And then I thought, well, if I put these all together and write a couple of introductory chapters and a conclusion, I pretty much have myself a book. But then, of course, the challenge became, should I write that book? Because these kinds of teachings and experience are highly personal. And I didn't want to offend the plant spirit because I knew she would kick my ass the next time I go to ceremony if I did anything egoic, you know?
Yeah. It's funny. Sorry to interrupt. It's interesting that you say that because, you know, I had Darren Austin Hall on the podcast a while back, and I've known Darren for years, you know.
Yeah, he's a friend of mine too.
Yeah, so working with the natives and doing that. And that's one of the things that I brought up with him as well is, you know, we're starting to see this resurgence of ayahuasca, and I'll just use ayahuasca, but plant medicine generally speaking. And I, you know, when I first started getting into this sort of stuff, which was probably about, I would say about 20 years ago now, it was always my understanding that you would go to the place that the medicine was from, right? So that medicine is from the jungle. So you got to go to the jungle, work with the shamans. That's the place. And something that he sort of brought to my attention was, well, look, the times have changed and the plant medicine is now coming here. And so I find it interesting, you know, the plants basically instructed the shamans to travel and to bring that out to the rest of the world. And so I think that that's kind of what you're getting at as well, is because I do agree with you. I mean, personal experiences in ceremony are rarely shared outside of ceremony.
Yeah,
you know, especially in a tribal or indigenous setting, you're allowed to speak those things in ceremony, but that's it. And so, were you instructed then that this was, you know, this was a good thing to do, that people needed to hear this message?
Yes, in a certain way. Just for those people who've never sat in an ayahuasca ceremony, what often happens is, or usually happens, is you have the conversation the next morning, which is you sit in a circle once everyone's had a bit of sleep and you talk about your experiences. So the night before, the evening before ceremony, because their ayahuasca is consumed at night,
right?
You speak your intention. So you might, and the intentions are as varied as the number of people there. It might be anything from I want to heal my relationship with my father to I want to perform better in my sales job. I mean, they don't always even have to be very spiritual intentions. Mm-hmm. And then what you get during the night, and then the next morning you share with the group, you know, what happened to you and what you learned. People don't always, they don't have to share everything, but it's offered and it's usually very beneficial. And also the shamans like to keep track of what your experience was so that they can help you more. So I specifically asked the medicine in an ayahuasca ceremony, what would you feel about my writing a book? This was another ceremony past the first 12. And and I also said, you know, what do you want me to do? Because given everything I've learned, I feel compelled to live a life of service. And by that point, I'd left my job and I really wanted to devote myself full time to the spiritual path and the shamanic path. And I said, you know, should I apprentice with a curandero in Peru and learn how to serve ayahuasca and such? And the medicine voice very clearly said to me, no, you don't need to do that. I've got lots of people to do that. Your medicine is your writing. That's your medicine bundle. You're a communicator and you've had 25 years being of service to the Gaian Oversoul with your environmental stuff, even though I wouldn't have thought of it that way at the time. Mm-hmm. And the communication was, yes, you can communicate this stuff because the planet is in great peril and she needs as many people to hear these teachings as possible. And although ayahuasca is not for everybody, we need as many people to have these experiences and be transformed by them as are called to do so. And I just want to put in a quick side comment here that my intention is not necessarily that everybody drink ayahuasca that is exported from Peru or that they travel to Peru to drink ayahuasca. There are many other teacher plants, and there are in fact people who are working on what are sometimes called anawaskas or analogs of ayahuasca. You can make, and these have existed for thousands of years, for instance, in the country that is currently Iran and Syria and Turkey. They worked with a pergama, I'm going to butcher this, but you know, a harmaline ayahuasca-like substance that used a very similar MEOI inhibitor and a similar DMT-rich hallucinogen. So there's quite a bit of evidence, actually, that some of the visions that are described in ancient texts and even in the Old Testament of the Bible were engendered by the use of psychotropic plants. So we don't have to constantly harvest the increasingly hard to get mature ayahuasca vines from Peru. We can actually make very similar visionary plant medicines from plants that are indigenous to North America.
Yeah. Wow. Like there's, thanks for that, because you just touched on so many different things there. I'm going to see if I can pick up on the things that I really would like to talk about, because first of all, let's just revisit what you were just saying, which is the fact that plant medicine has existed around the world for tens of thousands of years. You know, this is something that I've looked at extensively, and I've been reading about this and researching this for longer than I've done anything else in the holistic health space. Mm-hmm. And what I've always found fascinating is I always ask myself, you know, how is it that civilization and spirituality sprung up in a relatively short space of time in all parts of the world? And if you start looking at rock art, if you start looking at structures and whatnot, you find so many similarities. And they, you know, how did it travel, right? How did it get there before people could really travel in that sense? That, you know, communication was non-existent at that point, unless it was very localized. And so that always got me, you know, back in the day, really got me thinking. And I was like, wow, you know, the plant medicine, depending on where you are, I mean, we've spoken about ibogaine, we've spoken about ayahuasca, we've spoken about some of these other, magic mushrooms and psilocybin. These were present all around the world, just different plants in different areas, right? But all with the same type of purpose or intention, if you want to look at it like that. So the reason why I'm mentioning this is because for a lot of people listening out there, if you haven't been looking at this type of stuff, people often think that this is a new thing. They often think that this is a trendy thing, and this is a, you know, this because natural medicine has become so popular now that this is just another form of natural medicine. And I always like to sort of reinforce and highlight the point that this is in fact the oldest medicine that we have.
Yeah, yes, I would, if people want to dive into some research on this, there's a couple of books that are just fabulous. One of the books that was part of my research before I went to Peru and really got me off the couch to go and do it and not just be an armchair psychedelic traveler was Graham Hancock's wonderful book, Supernatural, Conversations with the Ancient Teachers of Mankind.
Yeah, an amazing book. Double down on that. An amazing book. Yeah.
In that book, he travels and he tries out different entheogenic plants from around the world and reports on them. And that was very useful research. Another more recent one is a fascinating book called The Psychedelic Gospels by Jerry Barry Brown and his wife Julia Brown, and that makes a very compelling case that psilocybin mushrooms and Amanita muscaria mushrooms were used by the Christian church elders, not just in the early church, but right up until the time of the Inquisition. And Brown is a mycologist, so unlike a lot of art historians, he found that those were mushrooms in a lot of the stained glass in Chartres Cathedral and elsewhere. He spent several years going around the world looking at evidence that there was a kind of happy alliance between the Christian church and the pagans throughout the medieval period and the Renaissance. But then with the Inquisition, what we would now refer to as the shamans of Europe, male and female, were all killed in the hundreds of thousands, if not millions. Mm-hmm. And it basically, you were signing your death warrant from that time on if you dabbled in that stuff. So suddenly the mushrooms disappear from the Christian art and iconography. Mm-hmm. But one of my motivations to try ayahuasca was I felt, you know, as Graham Hancock argued, this was the sacred sacrament and spirituality of mankind for tens of thousands of years. And I'll be damned if I'm going to go through my human lifetime and not even try it once to see what it was that they experienced. And then another great influence on me was Terence McKenna, and I've read his book.
For sure, yeah.
And listened to probably hundreds of his recorded talks on YouTube. And and as happened to McKenna, you know, I found that when I first drank ayahuasca, one of my reactions the following day was a feeling of anger, because I felt, my God, I've been deprived of this sacred, beautiful experience. This has been kept from me by my materialist culture, my colonial settler culture for that matter. And it became very clear to me, as Timothy Leary used to say as well, that, you know, the system wants us to be docile workers with our heads down, being good consumers, working in offices, and being productive for the consumer society. It doesn't want us, you know, tuning in and dropping out and connecting with these other sources and energies. But as you know better than me, the psychedelics, we're going through a psychedelic renaissance right now.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely,
It's coming into the culture. The young people in their 20s and 30s are certainly very aware of it. And it's a little bit different. I'm old enough, you know, to remember how it was in the 1970s when there was definitely a dark side to LSD. And what's different now is that it's coming with some tradition. It's coming with some intentional values and a sense of the sacred. So I think it's going to stick this time. And I think it's actually represents a sort of orthogonal attack on the battleship of late stage predatory capitalism. You know, just as our mm-hmm. Earth is getting into deep trouble with the rapaciousness of a system in which the destruction of the environment is practically baked in to the spreadsheets of corporations, there's an awakening going on, and the teacher plants are certainly a big part of it.
Yeah, and I'm so glad you put it beautifully, because you know, we do find ourselves this far down the garden path, and people are really looking for answers. I mean, this is why natural medicine as a whole has become so popular, because people have really lost faith in the conventional medical system. People are starting to dial in. I mean, it's blatantly obvious now. There is widespread environmental destruction, ecosystem collapse, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, going on in all corners of the world. There is nowhere that is immune at this point. And I think that people are starting to dial in that we have to find outside or out the box. You know, we have to think outside the box, and we have to find alternative ways, which in this case is not really alternative at all. It's actually going back to the original way to really move us forward. You know, one thing that I've always said for years is we need to look backwards towards the future. And it's kind of what we're doing, you know, in all facets, actually. And natural medicine is really one of the areas that's really propelling this forward, because we're looking at old school remedies, different ancient ways of actually healing ourselves on a much more profound and deeper level. So I agree with you that I do firmly believe that we're in this renaissance, and I do believe that it's going to stick 100%.
Yeah, I know that some of my friends and I, when we first you know, got into this, and especially recently, I've been doing a bit of work with edible cannabis, which is for me a hallucinogen or psychedelic, and also DMT, and especially the toad sacrament, the 5-MeO DMT that not a lot of people know about. We have a feeling that, oh, we're opening up new territory, and that's true. But in a sense, it's a large recapitulation of things that people knew thousands of years ago. Mm-hmm. I'm very fond of Terence McKenna's term, the archaic revival, which was also the title of a book, because, you know, he correctly diagnosed that whether it's people getting tribal tattoos or engaging in different sexual styles or being like hippies at music festivals or whatever it is, there's a desire for community and a desire for the kind of spirituality connected to direct felt experience and nature that we were very divorced from since the Industrial Revolution and the rise of, I'll just call it, predatory capitalism. I mean, just look at a photograph of, say, an IBM workplace from the 1960s, and everyone wearing the matching dark suits and ties and horn-rimmed glasses and the military haircuts. You know, we were very militarized, disconnected from source culture until very recently. And the way I view it, this is my perspective, is a huge collision of East and West happened in the 50s and 60s when Eastern religion and practices like meditation and yoga entered the West. And mm-hmm. especially in places like California. And I remember in the 70s, everyone was reading Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance and that stuff. And, you know, it came in it would have been hard to believe then that you would have the situation of today where there's a yoga studio on every street corner. And even though the style of yoga that's being practiced is the asanas and it's the hatha style that tends to be more like a gym workout and a fitness routine, that's laid the groundwork. And now there's another wave coming in for which those yoga studios and meditation practices laid the groundwork. And it's now that now people are starting to get interested in the real yoga.
Yeah.
And the deeper connections. And they're starting to wake up to what yoga and meditation can actually achieve in the individual escaping from the bondage of self or the illusion, the illusory self. So it's quite profound. And at the same time, I see shamanism and teacher plants coming into the culture. So for example, my friend Brendan Ring wrote an interesting book called A Kundalini Shamanic Awakening, which you can get on Amazon. And that's, I think, emblematic of what is possibly happening, that we're actually going to combine in a freestyle way and in a modern way, various traditions that used to be separate. And we're innovating as well. Unfortunately, we sometimes run up against accusations of cultural appropriation and some of that is legitimate. There is a dark side to the ayahuasca industry in Iquitos and stuff like that. So we have to acknowledge that. But I do think that we can't afford the nicety of saying that white people can't do this and they can't do that totally, because if we don't transform the situation on a global scale, there's not going to be anybody left to debate that.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think, 100%, you know, when I first started working intensively with the natives, that was one of the issues that I actually had to work through. I felt guilty for being there, mm-hmm. and I felt that I shouldn't be there. And, you know, one of the first things when I first stepped onto the native land, and at the end of ceremony, they said, "Welcome home." I had tears in my eyes, and I was like, yeah, you're right. Like, I feel like I'm home. This is tripped out, man. Why do I feel like that? And they're like, 'cause you're supposed to be here. Yeah. And I was like, okay, so I'm supposed to be here. And then getting into ceremony, I was like, man, but I'm a white guy. Like, my, you know, white people are just terrible. Like, go and look at history, and we're colonialists, we're capitalists. And so I had to work through all of that. And I had to come to the realization that we have to embrace the shortcomings and the atrocities of our ancestors, but we also have to use that as part of our own growth and education, if you will.
Absolutely.
And then step into your own medicine so that you can take it out there. And
yes.
That's been my experience. That's been my journey. And I have now lived a life of service for, I don't know, the last 15 years or something like that. But so I think you're spot on. And another thing that you sort of pointed at, which is also interesting, you know, someone asked me recently, I did an hour long, it was a YouTube interview or something like that, I forget, with a guy from England. And, you know, he said to me, he asked me the question, you know, people who are embarking on the spiritual journey, what advice would you give them? What would you caution them against? And I sort of said, well, I said, you know, here's my advice is don't get too wrapped up on one thing. Because you're going to find that there's different types of medicine in different places, and you need to latch on to what resonates with you. And you're going to find that there's never or rarely is there going to be one type of spiritual discipline that is going to have absolutely everything in it for you. Mm-hmm. And so when you talk about, you know, Kundalini and shamanism and that, it resonates with me because I've looked into all of those things. And then of course, earth-based medicine with the natives and, you know, Ayurvedic medicine, I'm well-versed in Ayurvedic medicine. So, you know, bringing all of this together, it's just a question of time, dedication, persistence, and just learning more. Until you find that, you know, there's certain things from these disciplines and you can sort of cherry pick over them if you want. And I wouldn't call that cultural appropriation. I wouldn't call that anything negative. It's really bringing these ancient spiritual disciplines into a modern context.
Yes, that's well put. There's a line that one has to walk in terms of, you know, like, I mean, I'm not going to go and put on an Indian feather headdress and go to a bar and watch a football game because to me that would be offensive to something that's deeply important to First Nations people. Mm-hmm. But by the same token, I view myself as a citizen of the world, and we need more people who are embracing their humanity in an international sense and can look for and make use of tools that are available from all around the world and different cultures. And as long as we have at least some genuine intention to learn some of the tradition that we're making use of, I think it's entirely appropriate to move forward in much the way that, say, white rock musicians in England learned from Mississippi Delta blues, black people in the 1950s and 60s. At some point, cultural appropriation has to yield to creativity and compassion and love and celebration. So that's what I'm about. And speaking to that, one of the first things that happened to me when I was I was wearing some Shipibo clothing for my first ayahuasca ceremony in the jungles of Peru, and ayahuasca really kicked my ass and and showed me. I had a long part of a major night being shown how I do manifest the colonial settler culture. And even though I thought I'm very hip and progressive, I was told, you know, you're basically an asshole and you're down here because you want to get the street cred to go home and brag to your new age friends that you're the cool guy who drank ayahuasca. And I was so humiliated that I actually went back to my cabin and took those clothes off and just put on some shorts and a t-shirt. And I wasn't going to go back to the ceremony, but they came and fetched me. And when I went back into the Maloka, I instantly got that telepathic communication, like, okay.
Like, you got it. Yeah.
Yeah. I see that you understand. Like, I was crying. I was on my knees. Yeah. And then the particular curandero who'd been assigned to me sang me my own medicine song. And that was, it was at that point that the deep teachings began. And I was shown a lot of stuff that, well, I ended up having to write a book to encapsulate. But I was, and even what's in the book is only a tenth, if not a hundredth, of what I've been taught. But but the medicine itself needed to know that I was truly humbled before she was going to share her gifts. And so now, of course, I have a bit of a problem sometimes because I might be in a situation in North America and a First Nations person here might look at me and on the outside, you know, I do look like everything that has oppressed them for 500 years. But in my heart, I had that experience like you had, the welcome home. And I realize what we've lost along the way, being divided, living in an alienated way, getting sick with our food, poisoning our environment, and not really living in community. So my goal for myself as I get older is not anything. I'm off that train ride now. I call it the ghost train of late stage capitalism, where people are beggaring thy neighbor and trying to have the baronial home and trying to fill the inner void with possessions or having power over other people and being higher in the hierarchy inside a corporation. None of that means anything to me. And what I value is service and community. And I want to, as I get older, I want to be surrounded by people who are living more in the way, even though we may be in a modern setting, but living more in the way that our forefathers and grandmothers did, you know, thousands of years ago.
Yeah, with that same sort of mindset and intention, right? Where we're living in such an individualistic society where it's dog eat dog, everyone is separated. As much as we're being told that technology is connecting us, in some ways it is connecting us, but in many ways it's really driving us further apart. And so I hear your message, and it definitely hits home for me right in the heart space. So Guy, look, I don't want to take up too much more of your time. We've been going for a good while now. I could definitely keep on going. Just not sure if our listeners would be keeping up with us for another hour.
Yeah, so, well, we can always do another one later on.
Exactly. So I think I would love to get you back on the show. But, you know, we didn't really dive deep into the contents of your book. And perhaps that's what we'll get to next time on the show. But I've loved the conversation. I think it's your experience and your insight and some of the teachings that you've shared on this show with me have really resonated a lot. Some of them I've shared, some of them, many of them I have not. And so I thank you for your contribution to the world and for what you're doing and bringing these types of teachings out into the wider space.
Thank you very much. And I just want to mention one final thing as we wrap up. The book, again, it's The Year of Drinking Magic, and it's available in paperback and as an ebook on Amazon. And you can also order it through bookstores because it's being carried by the world's largest book distributor. But I wanted to mention that all of my royalties from the book are being donated to the Amazon Rainforest Conservancy, which is a Canada-based philanthropy with charitable status. And what we do, I'm on the board of that, and what we do is we purchase or obtain long-term leases for lands in the Amazon to keep them out of the hands of predatory, of loggers and wildcat miners and such in the Peruvian Amazon. So this book is a work of service. And when people purchase the book, at least my portion of the sale goes directly to help save the Amazon, where I first had my awakening. So
amazing.
I wanted people to know that.
Yeah. And so, Guy, what we're going to do is, for those of you listening out there, check the show notes. You're going to find links to the book. You're going to find links to the organization as well, and any other links that that Guy wishes to share. So go back onto the webpage for this. You'll see all of the links there. For those of you who have perhaps had these experiences, definitely a book worth checking out, because it is a firsthand, very personal account of the ayahuasca experience itself and the sort of revelations that followed. And for those of you who have been thinking about this or have just started dipping your toe in the water, I think that this book would be fantastic to give you a pretty thorough overview, if you will, of what this experience really is, why it's important, and hopefully inspire you along your own spiritual path. So, Guy, I'm going to wrap it up there, but thank you so much for being on the show. It's been an amazing conversation, and I wish you nothing but the best with the book and on your quest. And we will definitely be in touch with you real soon, and hopefully get you back on the show.
Thank you very much. Have a good one.
All right, you too. Take care.